Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I will be your host this morning. Today on The Mole, we take aim at the Pentagon, the corporate media, the Olympic Games, and the nuclear family, institutions large and small that work to keep the gears of capitalism grinding on. First up, Lori Mercier speaks with Nettie Crawford about how the U.S. war machine contributes to global warming. After that, we bring you excerpts from an opinion piece by Rebecca Solnit about how the mainstream media is fashioning Joe Biden into a loser. Following that, we have Desiree Heligers in conversation with Jules Boykoff about the long history of racism, sexism, and classism of the Olympic Games. We'll close our show with a review by Larry Bolden of a memoir by Adrienne Brodeur about a horribly dysfunctional mother-daughter relationship. Before we get rolling, let me remind you that you are listening to community-powered radio that is not beholden to any corporate interests. That's why we need your support to keep KBOO going. If you can, please go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button. Or you can text KBOO to 44321. The KBOO community thanks you for keeping us on the air. According to the U.S. Department of Defense's own accounting, our military pumps out annually as much carbon into the atmosphere as the entire country of Sweden. The world's chief enforcement arm of global capitalism is thus a chief contributor to climate chaos, which in turn is a major driver of global armed conflict. It's a deadly downward spiral. Here's Lori Mercier in conversation with Nettie Crawford of Brown University's The Costs of War Project.
Good morning. I'm speaking with Nettie Crawford, who is the Montague Burton Chair in International Relations at the University of Oxford and is co-founder and co-director of The Costs of War Project at Brown University. She's author of numerous publications, including the books Accountability for Killing, Moral Responsibility for Collateral Damage in America's Post-9/11 Wars, and Argument and Change in World Politics, Ethics, Decolonization, Humanitarian Intervention. Today, we're talking about her more recent book, The Pentagon, Climate Change and War, Charting the Rise and Fall of U.S. Military Emissions. Welcome to KBOO, Nettie Crawford.
Happy to be with you.
Well, first, let me say I'm a great admirer of the Costs of War Project. I've used it for many years, and if listeners don't know about it, we'll link to it on the Old Mole website. It's a great resource for tracking how the nation's resources are devoted to militarism. But let's talk about some of the arguments in your book, The Pentagon, Climate Change, and War. I think many of us instinctively know that wars and military expansion are bad for the environment, but your book actually provides the data to illustrate just how much carbon they're emitting. What is the carbon impact of the U.S. military?
The United States military is the U.S. largest energy user, and it is thus the United States' single largest greenhouse gas emitter. And to give a number to it, on average between 1975 and the present, it's been about 81 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent each year, which is larger than many countries, entire countries. Last year, which the U.S. emissions have been declining since the U.S. ended the post-9/11 wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, emissions were about 41 million metric tons. So the average of 81 million metric tons tells you that in the past they were much higher. They were around 110 at the peak. So last year's emissions were equivalent to the emissions of, let's say, Portugal.
And so you're saying in previous years, it was much larger, the equivalent of multiple countries' emissions.
Oh, it's always the equivalent of many countries. So think of it this way. Emissions are mostly driven by operations. So when the United States is at war, or in the Cold War, when there were a lot of exercises and many thousands of military bases and installations across the world, emissions were higher. So in 1975, the earliest year I was able to do a calculation, emissions by the US military for operations and installations were about 109 million metric tons carbon dioxide equivalent. And they peaked at 110 million metric tons in the 1991 Gulf War. So emissions track war and Cold War. So following the end of the Cold War, emissions dropped. And then at the beginning of the post 9/11 wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, they went up again. So that's how we understand the dynamics there. The more the military does and the more places it is, the higher their emissions. When the United States reduces military spending, is not at war in as many locations, does not have as many exercises with other countries or by itself, then emissions decline.
Well, we don't really have many examples of the U.S. Cutting its military expenditures with or without war, do we?
I'll tell you, the pattern is kind of interesting. There was a peace dividend in the post-1991 Gulf War period, and that's because both the United States and Russia cut their nuclear arsenals, they reduced their conventional forces in Europe, and overall, the United States reduced its vast footprint. It had, you know, during the peak of the Cold War, about 2,000 overseas bases. Through a process of what was called base realignment and closure, several rounds of base closures and consolidations led to nearly halving that number to about 1,000 military bases. So spending went down in the post-Cold War era, and the number of bases and operations dropped, and there was a marginal savings. But you're right, especially in the post-9/11 war period, that is from 2001 to the present, generally, the trend is, even when the United States is not in a hot war, its military spending tends to go up. And it's now sort of unmoored, in a sense, from war. The United States gives more money to its military annually for modernization, for equipment reset, that is repair, and for increases in salaries. So the military spending has increased steadily in the last two decades.
And as you point out, waging war is just one source of emissions. Preparing for it is another. What's the impact of military industries production?
Well, I think of this as really three kinds of emissions we need to keep track of. The first is, as you say, military industry preparing for war. All those companies and activities that give us the bombers and the ships and the ammunition. And that's in any one year about the same size as the Department of Defense's footprint, greenhouse gas footprint. So if in 2022 or 2023, emissions were around 41 million metric tons, then double that and you have the total emissions, because military industry is about as large or larger in emissions than the military itself. And then there are the wartime emissions, which we actually haven't talked very much about. I mean, exercises are one thing. Fighting a war is very greenhouse gas intensive because you increase the amount of activity that the military is doing to both get to the war zone and then operate in the war zone. The United States tends to fight far from its shores. Then there's also the destruction of places, the burning in 1991 of oil fields when Iraq withdrew, or in 2014, 15, 16, when the United States bombed ISIS oil fields. So that emits greenhouse gases as methane is released and puts carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And then there's also the emissions from reconstruction. And we know from new research done by Leonard de Klerk on Ukraine that reconstruction emissions are also very fossil fuel, greenhouse gas intensive. And that's because when you build anything in a country that's industrialized, or even just roads, you use a lot of cement and other greenhouse gas intensive material. And reconstruction can be a large part of the greenhouse gas footprint of any conflict.
And the United States has been supplying massive weaponry. I mean, is really responsible for Israel's continued bombardment of Gaza and the complete destruction of that narrow strip of land, which I understand is just in the first few months of the conflict were greater than the annual emissions of more than 30 countries. And so that kind of warfare, as you point out, not only has just the immediate emissions from all of the bombs and depleted uranium weapons and cluster munitions, but the long-term reconstruction efforts that also result in tens of millions of metric tons of CO2. You note that most of the documentation of the climate crisis begins with industrialization, but your book emphasizes the history of the U.S. military's initiatives to find and protect reserves of coal and oil as important drivers of carbon emissions and forest depletion. Say something about this focus on fossil fuel logistics.
Well, in the 19th century, there was a major transition away from arms and legs and animals and wind and waves powering militaries and moving them places. And what happened was, first with steamships burning a lot of coal, and eventually railroads and automobiles and so on, there was a desire to have access to those sources of fuel. So, for example, in the 19th century, the United States made a trip with Commodore Perry to find fuel in Japan to then set up coaling stations along the way. And in the subsequent wars, coal was an objective, both to find the coal or later oil, or to protect access to it by setting up a station so you could refuel, or to have commercial arrangements with a local government or industrial magnate so that you could have access to that fuel when you wanted to use it. So, for example, in the 19th century, the United States set up in Pearl Harbor a coaling station. Pearl Harbor being used as a station for refueling the U.S. militaries continued to the present. Most recently, between World War II and, in fact, just this year, a lot of that fuel was stored in huge underground tanks in Pearl Harbor for the use on ships or for aircraft. And that actually had to be closed recently because it leaked and poisoned the water at the local joint base, Hickam Pearl Harbor, and also threatened local water supplies in Honolulu. But the use of this one place for the United States in its wars in Asia and the Pacific in the 19th and the 20th century is an example of how a location can be vital for projecting U.S. power. And the location is chosen essentially because it's a very useful place for refueling.
And certainly that concern about fuel to provide the U.S. military has fueled U.S. policies in the Middle East, hasn't it?
The United States has long been concerned, you know, since really the end of World War I, that no single power be able to dominate supplies of fuel coming from the Middle East. So the British preserved sort of access to Persian Gulf, Middle East oil through the 1960s. And then in the 1960s, the United States really took over that role, took over some British bases, added their own bases and arrangements to protect access to fuel at certain choke points or to preserve the governments that they thought would be most friendly to either U.S. corporations or to the United States perspective in, you know, the commercial world or political world. And those arrangements, those bases, those tens of thousands of people and the equipment have endured. In fact, they are there today to protect access to fuel in part, but also access for other countries to trade in general. And that enduring interest persists despite the fact that the United States is actually importing much less fuel each year from the Persian Gulf region. So from my perspective, what you see here is that all that infrastructure that was put in place, you know, over the last 150 years or so becomes sticky. It's a legacy of interests and ideas, and then it becomes something that you want to protect just because you have it. And what we need to do, I think, is rethink the necessity for those bases in the Persian Gulf, for the arrangements that the United States has with Saudi Arabia and other countries to protect access to fuel, to in fact fund the militaries and support them with more weapons as we use less imported oil from that region.
This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. I'm speaking with Nita Crawford, author of The Pentagon, Climate Change, and War. Nita, you point out that paradoxically, the Biden administration put climate change at the heart of its national security and stressed the potential for climate change cause conflicts. But you note that the response to these conflicts increases the military budget and the military's greenhouse gas emissions. So how can concern about climate conflict and wars be redirected from militarization to cooperation and breaking the cycle of military expansion and industrial production?
Well, I think now there's basically a consensus that has emerged within the Pentagon and in the U.S. national security community that climate change will lead to conflict, either conflict over natural resources like water or rare earth metals or other natural resources, or because people are migrating and this migration may create instability. Now, the problem with that view is that it's actually not supported by a ton of research. It's an assumption that's sort of rooted in our sort of evolutionary, I guess, analogies. We assume that when resources are scarce, people fight over them, but we actually have a lot more history to show that when resources are scarce, people buy them, they pay for them, or they work out arrangements so that you can share them. So conflict is possible, of course, with climate change causing increased stress for either, you know, regions or individual nations, but conflict isn't necessary, and you could work as countries do to manage water resources, either to make sure flooding doesn't happen or to make sure that there's enough water, or to help migrants who are pushed away from zones where it's no longer possible to live because of rising sea or because of the inability to grow food. It's too hot or too wet or too dry. And so what is important here is to think about both reducing the emissions that armed forces and every other part of our industrialized lives cost and cause, reduce those emissions, and then at the same time become more resilient by investing in alternative energy production, by working to store water and so on, become much more efficient in our energy use. So the best medicine here is, you know, prevention by reducing emissions and then adaptation, that is, and creating more resilience. And some of this can be facilitated by international agreements, trade agreements, and resource transfer to very vulnerable areas so that crises do not escalate to the point where people are responding with military force. There's a lot of work to be done here, but my main point is that while conflict is possible, it's not necessary and inevitable. In fact, there are many things to do to prevent it,
including redirecting all of those resources that are currently going to military use to more productive cooperative uses.
Well, I think it would be nice to reduce U.S. military spending, and it can be done. It would be good to reduce the geographic footprint of the United States. In its own estimates, the Department of Defense says that they have 20% excess capacity at their bases. So there's a way that those bases could be reduced. Right now, the best institution for responding in some instances to, let's say, fires or flooding events is to send in National Guard or the military itself. When we reduce military spending, we could bolster the institutions in the civilian sector that could respond to the natural disasters that may be either exacerbated or caused by climate change. And that's actually more efficient. Anything you do with an armed force is almost uniformly less efficient than what you do with a civilian or commercial response. So we have the resources for militaries to respond to natural disasters that are themselves caused by greenhouse gas emissions. But the military has those resources because we've invested disproportionately in the military. If we invested in other kinds of institutions for search and rescue, evacuation, and used those institutions, it would be cheaper and in some ways much more effective.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Nita Crawford. We'll link to your work on the Old Mole Variety Hour website. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, war machine keeps turning.
That was, of course, Black Sabbath with their classic song, War Pigs. Before that, you heard Laurie Mercier speaking with Netta C. Crawford about the climate costs of militarism. Last week on The Mole, we ran a piece about how the media fails to make the climate connections they should be making, given that climate change is an existential crisis for humankind, and we are rapidly running out of time to do much about it. This week, we offer another take on the sins of the corporate media. On July 6, Rebecca Solnit wrote a piece in The Guardian titled, "Why is the pundit class so desperate to push Biden out of the race?" She argues that the corporate media is hell-bent on making the Democratic Party and its candidate into a loser, which only increases the risk of a right-wing, anti-democratic takeover in November. Rebecca Solnit is a U.S. columnist for The Guardian. She is the author of Orwell's Roses and a host of other books. A link to the full article is posted on the page for this show at kboo.fm. Here are excerpts from Rebecca Solnit. "I am not usually one to offer diagnoses of people I've never met, but it does seem like the pundit class of the American media is suffering from severe memory loss, because they're doing exactly what they did in the 2016 presidential race, providing wildly asymmetrical and inflammatory coverage of the one candidate running against Donald J. Trump. They have become a stampeding herd, producing an avalanche of stories suggesting Biden is unfit, will lose, and should go away at a point in the campaign in which replacing him would likely be somewhere between extremely difficult and utterly catastrophic. They do this while ignoring something every scholar and critic of journalism knows well, and every journalist should. As Nicole Hannah-Jones put it, quote, as media, we consistently proclaim that we are just reporting the news when, in fact, we are driving it. What we cover, how we cover it, determines often what Americans think is important and how they perceive these issues, yet we keep pretending it's not so," end quote. Solnit goes on, "They are not reporting that Biden is a loser. They are making him one. According to one journalist's tally, the New York Times has run 192 stories on the subject since the debate, including 50 editorials and 142 news stories. The Washington Post, which has also gone for saturation coverage, published a resignation speech they wrote for him. Not to be outdone, the New Yorker's editor-in-chief declared that Biden not going away, quote, would be an act not only of self-delusion, but of national endangerment, end quote. And so it goes with what appears to be a journalistic competition to outdo each other in the aggressiveness of the attacks and the unreality of the proposals. It's a dogpile and a panic, and there is no one more unable to understand their own emotional life, biases, and motives than people who are utterly convinced of their own ironclad rationality and objectivity, aka most of these pundits. Solnit goes on in her article to draw attention back to issues of fitness for office when it comes to Trump. She has nothing new to add here, only to remind us that Trump is a convicted criminal and a fascist who seeks to destroy the remnants of U.S. democracy. Returning to the role of the media in this crisis, Solnit quotes a headline from Jeet Heer's recent piece in The Nation, quote, "Why aren't we talking about Trump's fascism?" Sometimes, Solnit goes on, I wonder if all this coverage is because the media knows how to cover a normal problem like a subpar candidate. They don't know how to cover something as abnormal and unprecedented as the end of the republic. So, for the most part, they don't. I want to emphasize that Solnit is no apologist for Joe Biden. She does not dispute the fact of Biden's frailty. But, as she writes, we are deciding whether this nation has a future as a more or less democratic republic this November, and on that rides the fate of the earth when it comes to acting on climate change. If the U.S. falters at this decisive moment in the climate crisis, it will drag down everyone else's efforts. But the shocking Supreme Court decisions this summer and the looming threat of authoritarianism have gotten little ink and air compared to the hue and cry about Biden's competence. Quite a lot of these pundits have been running magical realism fantasy football scenarios in which it is fun and easy to swap in your favorite substitute candidate. The reality is that it is hard and quite likely to be a terrible mess. The main argument against Biden is not that he can't govern, which would be hard to make given that he seems to have done so for the past years, but that he can't win the election. But candidates do not win elections by themselves. Elections are won, to state the obvious, by how the electorate turns out and votes. The electorate votes based on how they understand the situation and evaluate the candidates. That is, of course, in large part shaped by the media, as Hannah Jones points out, and the media is right now campaigning hard for a Democratic loss. The other term for that is a Republican victory. Few things have terrified and horrified me the way this does. That was Dirty Laundry by John Henley. Before that, you heard excerpts from a Guardian opinion piece by Rebecca Solnit. A link to the full article can be found on the webpage for this show at kboo.fm. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Local author and professor Jules Boykoff is a longtime critic of the Olympic Games for mass displacements of poor people from Olympic sites, staggering corruption, greenwashing, and more. On the eve of the Summer Games to be held in Paris, Desiree Hellegers speaks with Jules Boykoff about the Olympics, the resistance to the massive sports spectacle, and some of the alternatives which have sprung up from time to time.
My guest today is Jules Boykoff, professor of political science at Pacific University and the author of numerous books on social movements and the politics of sports and the Olympics, including his most recent book, What Are the Olympics For? Professor Boykoff is also a poet who's co-authored a book about the politics of poetry in public space with his spouse, Street Roots executive director, Kaya Sand. He's a former professional soccer player who frequently co-authors articles and commentaries with Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation. And the two will soon be in Paris covering the Olympics. Thanks so much for speaking with me today, Jules.
My pleasure.
Okay, and before we get going, I just want to note for listeners that you'll be reading from your new book, What Are the Olympics For?, this coming Thursday, July 18th at 7 p.m. at Powell's Books. So in What Are the Olympics For?, you offer a pretty scathing critique of the Olympics, and you make it really clear that concerns about doping in the Olympics have substantially eclipsed public discussion of a host of other critical issues, including, you know, staggering budget overruns, quote, displacement of local people, the militarization of public space, greenwashing, corruption, unquote, and basically on and on. Mm-hmm. I mean, you offer an overview of the origins of the modern Olympic Games beginning in 1894 in Paris with Baron Pierre de Coubertin, who convened, as you recount, a meeting of carefully selected allies, including King Leopold of Belgium, to move forward his vision for the modern Olympics, which would premiere in Athens in 1896. So can you talk a little bit about Coubertin and the elite interest that shaped and continue to shape the games, and about some of the protocols established by the International Olympic Committee, or the IOC, and the ways that these protocols have variously excluded, exploited, displaced, silenced, surveilled, and criminalized working class and BIPOC communities?
Absolutely. So the history of the Olympics is built on a firm foundation of racism, classism, and sexism. And it has a lot to do with the guy that you mentioned, that plucky French baron who restarted the modern Olympics in the 1890s. He himself was extremely sexist. He said at the beginning of those Olympics that women had no role in the games, that if they wanted to participate in the Olympics, they could place the laurels on the heads of the victorious champion men, or he said they could produce baby boys that could grow up to become Olympians. He was also a racist. He would say things about Africa whole cloth, saying they have 1,000 jealousies of the white man. That was a quote. And he would say, therefore, they should be allowed to participate in the Olympics. So it was kind of an awkward and odd construction, but he was racist to the core, anti-Asian, you name it. This guy said it. And third, he was classist. I mean, he was an aristocrat himself. As you noted, Desiree, when he set up the International Olympic Committee in the 1890s, he invited a bunch of his friends that were also dukes and princes and barons and kings, and they started the International Olympic Committee for themselves. I mean, if you were a mechanic or a bricklayer or a grape picker, you would not be included in the Olympics because you would be considered professional in the early days of the games. Well, of course, that left the field wide open for people like the Baron and his ilk to scoop up all these rewards. These men of leisure really benefited from those specific rules. And so you might think that that is just ancient history, but in reality, those decisions by Baron Pierre de Coubertin way back when actually continue to inflect the games today, where you have struggles over sexism, racism, and classism.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the ways that athletes and communities have pushed back?
Absolutely. So from the beginning of the Olympics, there were athletes who stood up against the injustices that are bricked into the sports mega event. There have also been communities that have said, you know, do we really want to spend our time and money on an optional sporting festival for like 17 days instead of the real deal issues that face our community? And so one of my favorite examples that a lot of people might not have heard about is from the 1906 Olympics in Athens, where there was this amazing athlete from Ireland named Peter O'Connor. And Peter O'Connor was an Irish nationalist and an ardent one at that. And yet, because Ireland was being ruled by Westminster at the time, he was forced to compete for Great Britain in those 1906 Olympics, and he was not at all happy about it. So when he won a medal and it was time to hoist the flag up the flagpole and get your prize, they hoisted up the Union Jack up the flagpole, and he ran over to that flagpole. He shimmied up it, and he pulled down the Union Jack and held up instead this Éireann Go Bragh, Ireland Forever flag over his head, while his two buddies, also Irish guys that were forced to compete for Great Britain, stood at the bottom of the flagpole to fend off the Greek police. Just an incredible moment. So from the beginning, athletes have been standing up. Same for communities. I mean, an example from the early days of the Olympics, 1932 Olympics in Los Angeles, happening during the Depression. You had protests in Sacramento, California, that had signs like groceries, not games. Fast forwarding to the 21st century, every single Olympic city, for reasons that we can get into, find themselves having protests against them, both in the lead up to and then also during the Olympics. And, you know, that athlete activist streak that I mentioned, maybe starting with Peter O'Connor, has gotten only more lively in our contemporary era. I think it's fair to say we're living in what we might call the athlete empowerment era. And so at the last Summer Olympics in Tokyo in 2021, postponed by a year because of coronavirus, you saw the U.S. shot putter, Raven Saunders, put her hands above her head to express support and solidarity with oppressed people everywhere, a clear breach of the International Olympic Committee's Olympic Charter, which says that athletes actually can't engage in protest inside of any Olympic zones. But she did it anyways and showed a lot of courage. So the history of the Olympics runs thick with pushback, both from activists and also from communities that are hosting the games.
Yeah, and I think most people are most familiar with is it the 68 Olympics in which Juan Carlos and Tommy Smith really took a public stand?
Absolutely. 1968 Olympics was an epic moment of athlete activism. So on the medal stand after the 200 meter dash, John Carlos and Tommy Smith put their fists in the air in solidarity with people around the world for human rights, for Black rights, for freedom, in support of the struggle. And they were part of a larger group. And I think it's important to note that this wasn't some wild card thing that just kind of happened in the spur of the moment. They were part of an activist movement, athlete activist movement called the Olympic Project for Human Rights. And they paid a real price for their courageous activism. They were kicked out of the Olympic Village. And the person who got also who placed and was on the medal stand with them, a white sprinter from Australia named Peter Norman, he also was punished because he wore a little button on his shirt that said OPHR, Olympic Project for Human Rights, this group that these athletes were involved with. And he, too, faced real consequences when he returned to Australia. And so that in that epic moment, I think we learn a lot. One, that athletes are willing to stand up against the overlords of the Olympics. And two, that typically when we see athlete activism, it's because there are these vibrant political movements happening around them of which they are a part.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the other organizations that have specifically taken on the Olympics and taken on the ways in which it saddles communities with debt, it promises to develop affordable housing and then instead creates housing for the wealthy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it might help to just sort of lay out exactly what you're doing there is what are the problems with the Olympics in the modern era? And one of them is costs. I mean, Olympic costs just go through the roof each and every time. And this puts taxpayers on the hook to cover the event. So basically, it becomes this sort of massive transfer of wealth upwards. You could call it trickle-up economics if you want. So that's one reason that people across the political spectrum, by the way, even fiscal conservatives will stand up on that particular issue. Another big issue that plagues the Olympics is that they tend to turbocharge gentrification and displacement in the Olympic city. So when Atlanta hosted the Olympics in 1996, you had the expulsion of unhoused residents given one-way bus tickets out of town before the Olympics started. You had 9,000 tickets being issued to unhoused people in the city of Atlanta, basically putting them on the treadmill of jail and making it more difficult for them to live their lives. The idea is you get rid of those folks before the Olympics start so that when the global media arrive, they don't see any social problems in their midst. A third problem is around militarization of public space to protect the Olympic spectacle. Basically, local and national security forces in the Olympic city and host country use the Olympics like their own private cash machine to get all the special weapons and laws and funding that they would never be able to get during normal political times. And so that's why you're seeing in France this summer, they're using AI-powered video surveillance to police the Olympic Games. They rammed it through the French Assembly on the idea that they needed it to police the Olympic Games. And so you can imagine people aren't that happy about that kind of racist technology in Paris. A fourth reason why people oppose the Olympics today is because of greenwashing. I mean, the Olympics talk a big green environmental game, but their follow through is absolutely lacking. You know, I lived in Rio de Janeiro in the lead up to the 2016 Summer Olympics there. I was a Fulbright research scholar. It was really fun. I went out to Guanabara Bay where they were hosting some of the events. Guanabara Bay was supposed to be cleaned up to make space for the Olympic Games. 80% of the water that flowed into this bay was supposed to be filtered. By the time the Olympics rolled around, only 25 to 30%. So a clear greenwash going on there. And there are just so many examples of it left and right. And finally, the Olympics bring with them just straight up corruption. I mean, here in the United States, we know that well because we saw what happened in the Salt Lake City Winter Olympics of 2002. That was a bribery-orama. I mean, they were bribing International Olympic Committee members for their votes, giving IOC members, family members, knee replacements and scholarships to attend college and tickets to the Utah Jazz basketball game, fancy violins, you name it. So because there's so much money swishing through the Olympic system, there also tends to be quite a bit of corruption. Unless you think it's some little vestige of our time in Salt Lake City, actually, currently there are four open investigations into corruption around the 2024 Paris Olympics. I doubt any of them will be resolved before the games start. But basically, corruption has become endemic inside of the Olympic Games. And because of that, you see activists that care about all those issues standing up just to say no when the Olympics come around to their city.
It sounds like there's also kind of international organizing, pulled together cities across the world that are fighting to keep the Olympics out of their communities.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that because that's a fresh development that's happened in recent years. And so prior to that, what you basically had was Olympic activism was a game of whack-a-mole. The Olympics would pop up into your city and you try to mallet it down with your activism. Then you just go back to your regular activism after that once the Olympics left. Well, back in 2019, activists convened in Tokyo to try to create more of a transnational anti-Olympics network. So you had activists from Tokyo, Los Angeles, Paris, Rio, England, you name it, previous places that hosted the Olympics in South Korea and all around the world. And they came together to share strategies and tactics to try to create, instead of it being an activist moment during the Olympics, more of an activist movement that sort of traveled between Olympic Games and supported communities that were experiencing the Olympics. They had their second ever transnational anti-Olympics summit in Paris in May 2022. And I did attend both of those and found them to be really interesting and well-considered from the activist point of view.
You also talk about the Workers' Olympics, which I never heard of, and which is a really interesting counterpoint to the exploitation of workers in the Olympics. Can you talk a little bit about that? What was the Workers' Olympics?
As I mentioned before, in the early days of the Olympics, workers were just sort of straight up banned from participating. They did change that pretty quick, in large part because they wanted to include famous soccer players in the Olympics, and they were clearly professional and they were going to make it work. But because of the exclusion of workers, workers said, you know what, we love sports and we're going to create our own event. And so in the 20s and 30s, there were a number of different workers' Olympics in various European cities. And they were largely supported by European socialists and communists. And they came together. And these were big events. I mean, you would get like more than 100,000 people to attend some of the ceremonies that were involved. And the other thing that was pretty cool about these was that there were moments and tears for those who are really serious about their sport. But there was also possibility for participation if you just wanted to give a sport a try or you weren't that good at it, but you just enjoyed it. And so unlike the sort of elite sport level Olympics of today, there was multiple levels so that all could participate. And it was a raving success. I mean, they had another big workers' Olympics planned for 1936 in Barcelona, but the rise of Francisco Franco and the fascists there kind of destroyed that dream. And one other thing I think is interesting, astride all this with the Workers' Olympics, there was also Women's Olympics. As I mentioned before, women were treated poorly by members of the International Olympic Committee. So they organized their own Women's Olympics. Again, in the 1920s and 1930s, these were tremendously successful. I mean, the sexism that flew through Olympic circles back in that day was epic. There was this idea that if a woman rode a bicycle, they would get this strange malady called bicycle face. This was the doctors of the time saying crazy stuff like that. And so they were barred from participating in various sports because it was considered unfeminine and so on. And so they said, you know what, we're going to organize our own Olympics. And those were tremendously successful, bringing in athletes from around the world and showing that women are perfectly capable with playing sports and not getting this mysterious made-up malady called bicycle face. And so, you know, out of exclusion was born ingenuity. And this is an interesting chapter in Olympic history.
In the book, you also talk a lot about the IOC's kind of longtime sympathies with South Africa during minority rule. And I know that in a Nation commentary in January, together with Dave Zirin, you talk about the IOC's disparate responses to the Russian invasion of Ukraine and Israel's unfolding genocide in Gaza. Can you talk a little bit about those disparities and the history of boycotts?
Absolutely. So the International Olympic Committee has a rather conspicuous tolerance for tyranny, and it goes way, way back. I mean, the International Olympic Committee held the 1936 Olympics in Berlin when Adolf Hitler was in power. They knew, they could see the writing on the wall. They could see the exclusion of Roma people. They could see the exclusion of Jewish folks. And yet they still rammed ahead with their Olympics, giving an opportunity to Hitler to sportswash and look really important on the world stage. Shimmy forward to the example that you're pointing out. Obviously, you have an apartheid system in South Africa that is being racist and discriminating against Black people. And yet the International Olympic Committee desperately wanted to continue to include South Africa in the fold. It was only because of pressure put on by activists, as well as athlete activists, as well as National Olympic Committees from numerous countries that said, we're not going to participate in the Olympics if you allow racist apartheid South Africa to continue. And so in 1964, the International Olympic Committee, against its will largely, decided to exclude South Africa from the Games. And they were excluded for almost 30 years until 1992, when Mandela came back into power. It was clear that there was a transition to a more just democracy. So that's an activist victory in a lot of ways. And it shows that the International Olympic Committee can exclude countries if they're violating the Olympic Charter, as well as just like basic norms of decency and kindness. Fast forward to today, like you're saying, you've got a real complex thicket of issues around this Olympics. I would say that the Paris Olympics this summer are the most politically charged Olympics that we will see in decades, for the reasons that you gave, Desiree. One being what's happening in Russia, the invasion of Ukraine. So when that happened, the International Olympic Committee was quick to act. It banned Russia from a lot of different sports. And now you have to sort of pass through this special rubric that shows that you're not supporting the war against the Ukraine in order to participate as a neutral athlete in Paris. It looks like there's going to be around maybe a dozen or so athletes from Russia and also Belarus that will be participating in Paris. But we'll see, because there's been some wrestlers that had qualified from Russia that have decided it's just not worth it. They're not going to go. And then the other situation, which is hanging over the head of these Olympics, which the International Olympic Committee has very much ignored, is what's going on in Gaza right now, the ongoing genocide in Gaza. And even though there have been tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians killed, the International Olympic Committee has remained silent and, in fact, has said that Israel will participate with no strictures in these summer Olympics. And so you have like the Israeli men's soccer team that qualified. And I'm going to guess that there will be protests in the streets against Israeli participation. There is a pretty robust movement online that has been fighting to try to get Israel excluded. And they're going to continue with their efforts through the Olympics. But I could go on about this, because I actually think that if you look at the way the International Olympic Committee has treated Israel, they have not been consistent in regards to how they treated Russia. The reasons that they gave to exclude Russia and to force them to participate as individual neutral athletes also apply, or at least one of them applies to Israel, and that was that Russia took over territory inside Ukraine, and then the Russian Olympic Committee used that territory to run sports clubs there. Well, hey, look at Gaza, where every single soccer stadium has been decimated, and where the Israeli Defense Forces took over the storied Yarmouk Stadium, soccer stadium, and used it as an internment camp and to interrogate people who they were detaining there. That sure looks a lot like what happened in Ukraine. Of course, history doesn't gift us with crisp facsimiles that are perfectly comparable in every single way, But the fact that the International Olympic Committee has said nothing about what's going on in Gaza shows that their ethical metric is quite skewed.
Thank you for that. My guest today is Jules Boykoff, and he's going to be reading from his new book, What Are the Olympics For? And that's this coming Thursday, July 18th at 7 p.m. at Palace Books. And check out also his July 8th piece with Dave Zirin. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Such a treat to speak with you, Desiree. Thank you.
This has been Desiree Hellegrish for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was a clip from Olympic Fanfare and Theme, written by John Williams for the 1984 Olympics and played here by the Boston Pops Orchestra. Before that, you heard Desiree Hellegrish speaking with Jules Boykoff about the Olympic Games. Beginning with the 1949 publication of The Second Sex by Simone de Beauvoir, second-wave feminist scholars have identified the nuclear family as a key social institution that, among other things, exploits the free labor of women and reinforces a system of patriarchy. Too often, the nuclear family also constricts opportunities for kids to form significant relationships with other non-parent adults, making children much more vulnerable to the psychological dependence on an impaired parent. What better illustration of this than Adrienne Brodeur's 2019 memoir about a particularly toxic mother-daughter relationship, one that plays out in a context of obscene wealth and white privilege. Bookmole Larry Bolden offers us a glimpse into the memoir with his review. Here's what Larry writes. As her epigraph for her 2019 memoir, Adrienne Brodeur chose a poem by Mary Oliver. Quote, "The Uses of Sorrow. In my sleep, I dreamed this poem. Someone I loved once gave me a box full of darkness. It took me years to understand that this, too, was a gift." End quote. I can't think of a better way to describe this haunting memoir by Adrienne Brodeur titled Wild Game, My Mother, Her Lover, and Me. The title itself is a double entendre, referring both to edible wild game and to the wild and dangerous game Malabar, the mother, enters into and makes her 14-year-old daughter complicit in. Brodeur tells her readers she has changed all the names in her memoir except for her mother, Malabar, her father, Paul, and herself. Perhaps this is part of why the memoir reads so much like a novel. Quote, "Wake up, Rennie." I felt a hand on my shoulder and pulled the sheet over my head. "Rennie, please. Rennie, wake up. Please, wake up. Sweetheart, please. I need you. Mom, what's wrong? Is everything okay? Ben Souther just kissed me." End quote. As I started this book, I was happy for Malabar. She is already divorced from her daughter's father and waiting for her lover's divorce to be finalized when he, Charles, has several strokes and is partially paralyzed on his right side. Malabar does the honorable thing and goes through with the marriage in spite of Charles' much reduced capacities. Malabar is a beautiful middle-aged woman of Indian descent who has lived a lonely life and has had a fractious relationship with her own mother. Perhaps while still married to Charles, she can snatch a bit of happiness with Ben, who is her husband's best friend. But very quickly, the story becomes darker and more twisted. Lies compound lies. I was much reminded of Iris Murdoch as I read this book. Murdoch loved to show how deceit snowballs. I'm thinking especially of her early novel, The Sacred and Profane Love Machine. The deceit itself is insidious, but Malabar's use of Rennie, her daughter, as a cover and an ally in carrying out the affair over years is truly awful. Perhaps I'm telling too much of the story, but the plot becomes obvious from the early pages. Rennie loves her mother and puts Malabar's happiness above her own. At first, she gets a kind of vicarious thrill from it, but soon she thinks of little else other than escaping her mother's influence and beginning her own life, extracting herself from the web of lies. Perhaps going away to college will be her escape. But Malabar's searing need draws her back again and again. Adding to the moral pollution of the story is the fact that Ben and Lily, his frail and devoted wife, are best friends with Malabar and Charles, and Ben and Malabar carry on their affair under the noses of their spouses. I am in many ways stunned by the audacity of Brodeur in laying out this story. Fortunately, there are parts of the ending of the story that redeem it some, and Rennie is able to more or less escape the suffocating love of her mother and to make her own motherhood and marriage so much better. In the end, I really was intrigued by this memoir, artfully written and stark in its honesty. I have been talking about Adrienne Brodeur's 2019 memoir, Wild Game, My Mother, Her Lover, and Me. And this is Patricia Kohlberg, reading as usual for Larry Bolden and for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That does it for our show this week. Thanks to Moles, Laurie Mercier, Desiree Helligers, and Larry Bolden for their contributions. And a special thanks to our guests, Netta C. Crawford and Jules Boykoff. As always, a shout out to the hardworking KBOO staff. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the morning. Next Monday morning, we'll look at Quaker solidarity with the Palestinians and government sabotage of the Hanford cleanup. Plus, a mole who once worked for her, no kidding, will offer some insight into Kamala Harris. Until then, stay safe and stay active. I'm going to go out today with the song That's What Makes Us Great, by Joe Grushecki and the House Rockers, and featuring Bruce Springsteen. Thanks for listening.
They come from everywhere, are longing to be free. They come to join us here, from sea to shining sea. And they all have a dream, as people always will, to be safe and warm in that shining city on the hill. Someone slammed the door instead of opening the gate. Why, let's turn this thing around right before it gets too late. It's up to me and you. Love can't conquer hate. I know it's true, but true. That's what makes us great.